minute," Roscoe said. "What practice attack? What are you talking about?"
"You have a depth of knowledge and wisdom we did not expect to find among the chiefs,"
Jixtus said.
"But I cannot say more when others may hear. If I may not visit your world and your patriarch, perhaps you can send a representative aboard the Whetstone for a more secure conversation."
Roscoe chewed at the inside of her cheek. But really, why not? There wasn't anything to lose. Surely Jixtus wouldn't try to harm her or hold her hostage. Not with a group of Chiss warships holding the Whetstone in their targeting sights. On the contrary, there was a lot to be gained by accepting such an offer. The Myth Patriarch had sent Jixtus away without trying to get a closer look at the Whetstone or even to learn more about Jixtus and the Kilgees. Now the Klar family was being offered the chance to do both.
"Very well, I accept," she said. "I'm sending you orbit information. Reposition yourself as instructed, and I'll be there shortly."
"We shall eagerly await your arrival."
Roscoe keyed off the comm.
"Feed him a mid-altitude orbit," she told Rupiov. "Make it a polar loop."
"A bit tricky to get to one of those from their current vector," Rupiov pointed out.
"That's the point," Roscoe told him. "Let's see how much trouble they're willing to go through to talk to us. And make sure the orbit never puts them directly over the homestead."
"Yes, ma'am," Rupiov said hesitantly. "You're really going up there?"
"Why not?"
Roscoe asked, watching the orbital data flow across the comm display as it was transmitted to the Whetstone. She couldn't decipher the numbers as quickly as a trained nav officer could, but it all seemed correct.
"Alone?" Rupiov pressed. "They're aliens, you know. We don't know what they're capable of."
"That's all right," Roscoe assured him. "They don't know what I'm capable of either. More to the point, this is my chance to get a close look at that ship, inside and out, and to actually meet these people, neither of which the myth bothered to do."
Rupiov's lips puckered in a smile.
"No, they didn't," he said. "That should make for some interesting conversations in the Syndicure."
"And possibly some good leverage points," Roscoe agreed. "Get me a shuttle and a pilot. I want them ready to fly as soon as possible."
"Yes, ma'am," Rupiov said. "They'll be outside the main entrance in 15 minutes.
15 minutes. Just enough time for Roscoe to tie back her hair, change into her dress uniform, and get to the main entrance to meet the shuttle. Whatever these aliens were really here for, she wanted to make her best impression on them. Especially since the Klar family dress uniform went so well with a holstered Charik. And since it also had a nice little concealed pocket that was perfect for a two-shot backup weapon. If Jixtus was planning trouble, he would indeed not know what she was capable of. Not until it was far too late. From the outside, the Whetstone looked like any other mid-class warship, with heavy Nyx alloy hull plating, weapons blisters scattered around its hull that housed lasers and missile launchers, and an ordered array of nodes marking the presence of an electrostatic barrier system. The peace ceiling that Rupiov and the Myth Report had both mentioned consisted of heavy metal plates bolted over the missile tubes and spectrum laser openings. They looked sturdy enough, but Roscoe suspected that they could be removed quickly if Jixtus decided he needed to fight. Still, whether the release mechanism consisted of explosive bolts or fracture metal, opening the weapons to combat status would give the planetary defenders a few seconds' warning. For the Klar family warships, at least, that would be more than enough. She couldn't speak for Patrol Command's competence. Two bipedal aliens were waiting for her inside the docking vestibule when the shuttle door opened. One was tall, with dark brown hair and wrinkled, rubbery-looking orange skin, wearing an outfit made up of half a dozen different shades of blue. The other was much shorter, a bit shorter than Roscoe herself, dressed in a black robe, hood, gloves, and a face veil that completely obscured everything except his basic body shape.
"I am Jixtus,"
the shorter alien identified himself. Here, in person, his voice sounded slightly less melodious and slightly more raspy than it had from the Defense Center speaker.
"I greet you, Captain Roscoe, and welcome you aboard the Whetstone. This is General Arius Nakir, ruler of the Kil-Gi-Lumum and master of this vessel. We appreciate your promptness. Allow us to show you to a place of comfort and refreshment where we may speak together at ease."
"Never mind the refreshment," Roscoe said. The Venturist was blasting its way toward them in hyperspace, and she wanted the aliens gone before Admiral Dyloth got here and tried to take over. "You spoke of a threat and a practice attack. I'd like to hear the details."
Being of direction and focus,"
Nakir said. His voice was far less melodious than Jixtus's, the Ta'arja words delivered in a grating monotone. But there was an intensity beneath the voice that sent a chill up Roscoe's back.
"I approve."
"I'm so glad," Roscoe said, regretfully aware that the sarcasm was probably wasted. "If one of you will lead the way..."
"Of course," Jixtus said. "Follow."
Turning, he walked through a hatchway at the side of the vestibule, Nakir striding along close behind. Brushing her forearm against the charik belted at her right side, feeling the additional reassuring pressure of the hidden backup weapon, Roscoe followed. The corridor was as utilitarian as the Whetstone's exterior. 30 meters ahead was an open hatchway with soft light spilling out into the gray metal passageway deck and wall. Jixtus and Nakir turned and disappeared through the opening. Again, touching her forearm to her holstered charik, Roscoe followed. She'd assumed the compartment would be more of the same cold metal and ceramic as the corridor in the Whetstone's exterior. To her surprise, she found herself in something that looked more like a child's playhouse. The walls were patterned with the pinpricks of colored chase pattern lights, while floating light globes hovered in each of the compartment's upper corners. The carpet was thick and brush-topped, and the round table and 6 chairs that dominated the room were made of contrast-carved wood. But at least the multi-screen set into the center of the desk was modern and efficient. The image on the displays showed 5 ships of various sizes and configurations set against a starry background.
"Please, be seated,"
Jixtus said, gesturing to the table as he and Nakir headed for the 2 chairs closest to the hatch.
"Thank you," Roscoe said.
She circled Nakir as he settled into his chosen seat, picking the chair to the tall alien's right, where she would have clear views of both the hatch and the display on that side. As an extra bonus, sitting there also put her charik and gun hand out of Nakir's reach. "Even paranoids," the old saying whispered through her mind, "have enemies."
"This recording was made in an unidentified star system 7 days ago,"
Jixtus said, pulling the multi-screen's control toward him.
"I believe you will recognize the ships as well as the activity."
He keyed a switch, and the image unfroze into a vid. Roscoe leaned closer, studying the ships. There was some distortion and fuzziness in the images, indicating that the scene had been recorded from some distance, but the view was clear enough for her to easily make out the larger details. Two of the ships were system patrol craft, of the sort that guarded Regal and every other inhabited world in the Ascendancy. Together with what appeared to be a light cruiser, they were circling one of the two larger ships. By its size and configuration, probably a freighter, firing barely visible laser shots at it and receiving fire in return.
Is this vid enhanced? She asked.
An insightful question, Jixtus said, a note of approval in his tone. Yes, the laser intensities have been enhanced for clarity. Otherwise, they wouldn't be visible to the unaided eye.
Roscoe nodded. So, a practice battle, all right. Moreover, one that the participants wanted to keep secret. There were no planetary bodies visible, and from the lighting patterns on the ships, she guessed that there weren't any just-off vid either. Official Defense Force training exercises were never held very far from a planet, since that was where most real-life combat took place. But Jixtus might not know that. It might be interesting to see what his response would be to that suggestion.
Probably just a training exercise, she said offhandedly. The Chiss Defense Force does a lot of those.
I beg to disagree, Jixtus said. This record was taken at a great distance from any habitation, and only a single recording vessel is present. No, I believe it to be a war game. Or,
he added thoughtfully,
a rehearsal.
I don't know why anyone would rehearse an attack on a freighter, Roscoe said.
So her tentative conclusion had been right, and Jixtus had just handed off a valuable bit of information for free.
Perhaps the target was the only ship they could find to use,
Jixtus offered.
Perhaps, Roscoe said.
So now he'd also confirmed that the target ship was a freighter. Two bits of information for free. This Jixtus really was terrible at negotiation.
Have you yet examined the observer's craft?
He asked. Roscoe focused on the other large ship. Now that she was looking more closely, she could see that it did indeed seem to be standing back and observing the exercise without taking part. It was larger than the three attackers, possibly a light cruiser or frigate. Though with only its stern and part of its starboard flank visible, it was hard to tell for sure. As she watched, the ship shifted position, pitching its bow upward slightly and yawing a few degrees to starboard. And Roscoe felt her breath catch in her throat. It was a frigate, all right. The fifth largest Chiss warship behind heavy cruiser and the three man-of-war classifications. The markings on the hull were still blurry, but for a Klar family military officer, there was no mistaking the crest that marked it as a Dasklo family frigate. She looked back at the patrol craft and cruiser. They also had family markings she could see now, but those ships were smaller and farther away, and the resolution of the vid wasn't quite good enough for her to make them out.
Can you give me more magnification? She asked.
Sadly, no, Jixtus said. This is the full stretch of Kilgee capabilities.
Roscoe pursed her lips. So tantalizingly close. But just because the Kilgees couldn't enhance the vid didn't mean that was the end of the road. The equipment back at the homestead might be able to coax a little more out of the images.
I'd like to take this recording back to my people, she said. Maybe we can do more with it.
Of course, Jixtus said.
He keyed another switch, and the displays went blank. Another tap on the panel, and a cover flipped up, and a small rectangle popped out.
I trust you can read this,
he added, offering it to her.
Of course, Roscoe said, taking the card and sliding it into a pocket.
All the computers she was familiar with used data cylinders, but the Klar family traded with several alien species, and someone on Rigar ought to have equipment that could translate Jixtus's card into a more usable format.
I'll return it as soon as we've made a copy.
And at that time, you'll also bring my payment?
Jixtus asked pointedly.
As I told you before, we'll pay what we decide the information is worth, Roscoe said, standing up. But I think I can assure you the Patriarch will authorize a reasonable amount.
She turned and started toward the door.
And you said the star system where this took place is unknown?
Not unknown, Jixtus said. Merely unidentified.
Roscoe paused, frowning back over her shoulder at him.
What's the difference?
The difference, Jixtus said, is that I simply haven't identified it to you. Withholding that information is why I know you will return with my fee.
Roscoe's first impulse was to be furious. How dare an alien play with her that way? Her second was to recognize that there wasn't a single thing she could do about it. She had no choice but to give in to the extortion. Her third was to realize that maybe Jixtus wasn't as careless at negotiations as she'd thought.
Very well, she said. When I return with your recording and your payment, I'll bring enough extra to buy the location of the system.
Excellent, Jixtus said. I shall eagerly look forward to our next meeting.
He lifted a gloved finger.
One other thing.
He paused.
Yes,
Roscoe prompted, clamping down on a fresh ripple of annoyance. She'd never appreciated dramatics, visual or verbal, and she especially didn't like them in combination.
If it should turn out that your Patriarch and his family are indeed in danger,
Jixtus said,
General Arius Nakia and the Kilgis stand ready to assist in your defense.
Do they now?
Roscoe said, eyeing the taller alien.
What would this assistance consist of?
We have many mighty ships of war,
Nakir said.
Some could be put at your disposal if you felt the need.
I appreciate the offer, Roscoe said. But I think the Klar family can handle this on our own.
Of course, Jixtus said. I simply wanted you aware of all the alternatives.
Trust me, Roscoe assured him darkly. I'm aware of them.
She looked at Nakir, visually running his Whetstone battlecruiser against the Klar defense profile. Maybe these ships would be powerful against pirates or raiders. Not so much against a family of the Nine.
I'm aware of all of them.
Roscoe was right on two counts. The Klar techs were indeed able to read and copy Jixtus's unconventional data card. They were also able to dig more information out of the recording.
The frigate is definitely Dasklo, your Venerante,
Roscoe confirmed, touching the distinctive family crest on the image frozen on Patriarch Clarivalexau's desk display.
But here's the interesting part. One of the patrol ships is Aragol. The other patrol ship and the cruiser are Zodlak.
Zodlak,
Rivlex echoed, stroking his lower lip thoughtfully as he peered at the display.
Not a family I'd expect to be working with the Dasklo.
I agree, Rosku said. Given the Zodlak closeness with the Arisi, my concern is that this may signal a new alliance between them and the Dasklo. That could pose a serious threat to us.
I think that unlikely,
Rivlex said.
The Arisi are quite heavy-handed with regard to their allies, and the Dasklo are hardly noted for their ability to work smoothly with others.
Maybe they've learned, Rosku said. Or maybe the impetus isn't coming from either family.
Meaning?
Meaning the suggestion may have come from the Zodlak.
Rivlex's eyebrows went up with polite skepticism.
One of the 40 pushing one of the 9? That's even less likely than the Dasklo learning some manners.
One of the 40 who used to be a ruling family, Rosku reminded him. And what if it wasn't just the Zodlak? What if it was a newly formed alliance among the Zodlak, Aragol, and Pomrio?
Why would they...
Rivlex broke off, his eyebrows abruptly lowering into a thoughtful frown.
Exactly, Rosku said. Everyone's been assuming the recent military action at Hoxim was either some absurd treasure hunt or else a huge mistake. But ask yourself this. How could 3 members of the 40 make the same mistake?
You think their meeting was a cover for something else?
Possibly, Rosku said. Or else they really were all lured out there somehow. But in successfully defeating the alien gunship attack, they realized they worked well together.
Interesting theory,
Rivlex murmured.
But that's not what I'm reading in the reports.
Reports are made out by the participants themselves, Rosku said. Reports that could easily have been edited by the 3 families to say only what they wanted the rest of the Ascendancy to read. In that case, what Jixtus's source may have recorded was a combat demonstration, the Zodlak coordinating with the Aragol to show the Dasklo what they can do.
It doesn't make sense,
Rivlex said firmly.
Patriarch Loiversi would never accept overtures from one of the 40. Alliances with the Dasklo invariably travel the other direction, from him outward.
Unless, as I said, we're starting from an alliance among 3 of the 40, Rosku said. I'll also note that Sarvchi, where the Pomrio family ships and crews assembled for their trip to Hoxim, is home to a Dasklo stronghold.
One of their smaller strongholds.
But with an important manufacturing facility, Rosku persisted. For that matter, who says this dance among Zodlak, Arisi, and Dasklo is all that's going on? If the Pomrio are part of it, what if they're also trying to talk the Plick into this new alliance? Or have already done so?
That makes even less sense,
Rivlex said.
The Plick wouldn't make any such deal without consulting with us first.
Wouldn't they? Rosku countered. Just because our families have been allies for a couple of generations doesn't mean they wouldn't turn on us if something more advantageous came along.
It would have to be significantly more advantageous.
I submit that a solid alliance among them, the Arisi, the Dasklo, and 3 of the 40, would qualify.
The key word, being solid.
Rivlex pondered a moment.
No. No, I don't find your reasoning compelling. However,
he added, lifting a hand as Rosku opened her mouth for a protest.
Stranger things have certainly happened throughout the course of Klar family history. Just because I don't believe this alliance is likely doesn't mean we should ignore the possibility. Especially given that the Zodlak seem to feel the need to demonstrate military prowess to the Dasklo.
Rosku felt her throat tighten. Family rivalries and challenges normally played out in the political and economic arenas. In this case, a combined Dasklo-Irizi group could bring the kind of pressure that might result in significant concessions from the Klar. Some of the Klar farming and processing facilities on Ornfra might change hands, or possibly the big electronics manufactory on Jamiron, both of which the Dasklo had been salivating over for years. It would all be neat, quiet, and civilized, and was the sort of thing that happened all the time in the Ascendancy. But if the Dasklo and Zodlak were out in the middle of nowhere playing war games...
"You have a plan, Your Venerante?"
she asked.
"I do," Rivlek said. "First, you'll go back to Jixtus with enough to pay for this sample and the location where this event took place. If there's more of this vid, you'll purchase that as well."
"Yes, sir," Roscoe said. Both were points she'd been planning to suggest if he didn't. "I didn't ask him about the cost."
"Whatever it is, pay it," Rivlek said. "If this is all a fraud, we'll find a way to deal with him later. After that, we'll send one of our ships to check out the location and see if we can glean any more information."
"Yes, Your Venerante," Roscoe said. "May I also suggest a quiet tour of some of our major holdings throughout the Ascendancy? If someone is plotting against us, there may be signs of that elsewhere."
"Reasonable idea," Rivlek agreed. "Do you have a suggestion as to ship and captain?"
"Yes, sir, I do," Roscoe said. "I suggest the Orison, commanded by me."
"Really?"
Rivlek said, cocking his head slightly.
"Forgive me if I'm mistaken, but I believe you already have an important position."
"Lieutenant Rupiov is more than capable of handling Homestead security in my absence," Roscoe said evenly. "More important, if the Dasklo and Zodlak are preparing something that involves their militaries, you'll want the Orison commanded by the Klar officer with the widest combat experience. That person is me."
"Is it?"
Rivlek said, a small smile twitching at the corners of his mouth.
"You have a high opinion of yourself, Captain."
"I'm merely stating facts, Your Venerante," Roscoe said. "And the most critical of those facts is that something happened at Hoxim, and something happened out there with Dasklo and Zodlak warships. We don't have nearly enough information on either incident, and we need to."
"I'm afraid I have to agree,"
Rivlek conceded, his smile fading.
"Very well, Captain. I'll order the Orison prepped, and inform Commander Ramos you'll be taking over. Go pack whatever you need for the voyage. Your shuttle might as well take you directly across to the Orison after you've dealt with Jixtus. And make it quick. I want both you and the Whetstone gone before the Venturous arrives."
"Understood, Your Venerante," Roscoe said, standing up. "Thank you."
"Yes,"
Rivlek said, his voice going a little odd.
"One final question."
"Sir?"
The Patriarch's eyes bored into hers.
"I trust this doesn't have anything to do with the fact that Jixtus apparently approached the Myth first, or the fact that Senior Captain Thrawn was also present at the Hoxim incident."
"Not at all, Your Venerante," Roscoe said, forcing herself to meet his gaze. "Not on either count."
"Because I know how you feel about him,"
Rivlek pressed.
"Whatever's happening here, it's too important to be compromised by other considerations."
"Trust me, Your Venerante," Roscoe said. "The fact that Thrawn's involved won't affect my investigation, my judgment, or my conclusions."
"Good," Rivlek said. "Go get packed. I'll speak with you again before you leave."
"You are disturbed,"
Nakir said.
"You are mistaken,"
Jixtus said.
The Klar Patriarch behaved exactly as I wished.
I wasn't speaking of the Klar,
Nakir said.
I was speaking of the news from your warship.
The veiled face turned slightly toward him.
What news would that be?
But there was a tang of irritation mixed in the Grisk's tone.
I don't know,
Nakir said.
I know merely that you haven't spoken to me as frequently since your return, and that your manner has become colder and less haughty. Has your lack of enlightenment finally made you recognize the value of the Kilchi Illuman?
Jixtus was silent a moment. The unseen face still pointed at Nakir. Nakir remained silent as well, waiting for the Grisk to reveal whatever secret he was concealing. The alien stirred, one gloved hand twitching in a sort of abbreviated gesture.
It's of no importance,
he said.
The facility where we hope to manufacture more of our small warships has been discovered and attacked.
By the Chiss?
Who else would attempt such a thing and still survive?
Jixtus growled.
Yes, by the Chiss.
Nakir said, stretching with cautious enjoyment. Jixtus was always so confident in his plans. Seeing him humbled by circumstances was a new experience.
And the facility?
Undamaged, but no longer useful,
Jixtus said.
Now that its location is known, we would need to intensify its security, and I don't wish to tie up the necessary warships.
The hand twitched again, this time making a more complete gesture of dismissal.
No matter. The ships that were to be assembled there would have permitted us to bring the crisis to a boil more slowly and more deeply. Now, we'll simply have to move up the timetable.
Or you could make up the loss with warships of the Illumin,
Nakir offered.
We stand ready to assist.
Jixtus gave a sort of bark.
Don't make me laugh, General Arius. The only part you can play is the one we've already given you. To conquer key border nations and close them off as havens to which Chiss forces or refugees might attempt to retreat.
We can do far more than that,
Nakir insisted.
You underestimate the power of the Kilchi Illuman.
No, I don't think so.
Jixtus said. His old edge of superiority now returned.
Be content and play your part, and the Kilgis will have millions of new prospects to bring enlightenment to.
And if we desire more?
There will be no more,
Jixtus said quietly.
But there can certainly be less.
He seemed to stir.
You have our next destination?
Nakir forced calm upon himself. The enlightened never let threats overwhelm their thoughts or wisdom.
I do.
Then let us be off,
Jixtus said.
Time is passing, General Arius. We cannot afford to let it leave us behind.
Understood,
Nakir said, gesturing to the helm.
Vessel One, you have your course.
I obey,
Vessel One said. He keyed the helm, and a moment later the whetstone was once again in hyperspace. Makir watched the flowing pattern, stretching in quiet resolve. No, the Enlightened didn't let threats overwhelm them. But they also didn't forget those threats. Not ever.
Memories 3.
Thras was seated at his new desk in the Syndicure office complex, skimming a report on crop projections for Sharb's northern hemisphere, when a data cylinder came sailing over the privacy divider on his left and landed on the desk. It bounced twice, then rolled to a halt beside his computer display.
Did I make it?
One of the other syndics asked, popping her head into view over the divider.
Where did it land?
There,
Thras said, pointing to the cylinder and frowning at her.
If you were trying for my desk, yes, you made it. And?
And what?
And what is it?
Thras asked, picking up the cylinder and peering at the side. The only labeling was a Defense Hierarchy Council sequencing number.
Part of the autolog record from the Expansionary Defense Fleet patrol cruiser Perala, she said. Syndic Furfian wants it analyzed.
Don't we have techs for that sort of thing?
Thras asked, holding the cylinder out to her.
Yes and no,
she said, making no move to take it.
Fairfian doesn't want anyone below Syndic rank even knowing he has it, let alone that we're digging into it. And you know the saying, last hired, first mired.
Right,
Thras said, suppressing a grimace. And since he was the latest addition to the elite group of aristocra who made up the Syndicure, he was the one who caught all the mudslog work, whether that work fit into his official responsibility sphere or not. In this case, decidedly not. His current job was overseeing Myth agricultural interests and coordinating with other families' farming and crop distribution systems. The Defense Force and Expansionary Defense Fleet were watched by Thurfian and one or two others who oversaw military activities and could, in extreme cases, offer support from the Myth family's own modest fleet of warships.
Anything in particular he's looking for?
Thras asked, sliding the cylinder into his computer's reader.
He thinks someone aboard the ship pulled some kind of scam, she said. Illegally fed assistance and information to a merchant hub station at some alien planet.
Wait a minute,
Thras said, frowning.
Illegally fed?
And then, abruptly, it clicked. The Expansionary Defense Fleet warship Perala stumbling into a pirate attack against a Garwian merchant hub station at Stivik 4 months ago. The pirates who'd been steadily beating down the Garwian defenses suddenly getting caught by an unexpected Garwian tactic and subsequently being destroyed or driven off. First Officer Mid-Captain Roscu insisting to the Council and the Klar Speaker that someone aboard the Perala had violated standing orders against Chiss intervention in the affairs of other nations. The ship's commander, Senior Captain Ziara, insisting in turn that no one aboard her ship had done anything wrong, and that they'd merely observed the battle from a distance. And standing squarely in the center of the controversy, Fourth Officer Senior Commander Thrawn.
Yes, that's the one,
the other syndic confirmed, correctly interpreting Thras's reaction.
Have fun, but be quick. Fairfian wants a report before lunchtime.
Understood,
Thras said, wincing as he opened the data files. the only reason he'd noticed this event in the first place was that Thrawn and Ziara were both mentioned in the report. Now, it appeared, they weren't just mentioned, but were up to their necks in it. Or, more likely, it was Thrawn who was up to his neck, and Ziara was once again trying to pull him out. Ideally, this should have been a purely military matter. But just because the Sindicure wasn't supposed to meddle in fleet business didn't mean they didn't occasionally invite themselves in. In this case, Roscoe's complaint had gotten the Klar involved. And now, Thurfian had responded by hauling in the Myth. If the questions dragged on long enough for the Arisi to notice that one of their own, Ziara, was also involved, they could soon have a full three-family Grouser jump pile on their hands. In this case, though, it wasn't clear as to how those piles would line up. Family sides with family. That had been the number one unspoken rule of life for millennia, since well before the earliest days of Starfleet and the establishment of the Chiss Ascendancy. But it didn't take much scratching beneath the surface of such platitudes to realize things were rarely that simple. And when a Myth Syndic's dislike for an individual was greater than his loyalty to his family, things could get complicated very quickly. Thurfian no doubt thought he was being subtle about his opposition toward Thrawn. But Thras had seen the signs in Thurfian's face and voice. And if he'd seen them, it was likely others had as well. Thras didn't know the source of the animosity, but in such things the usual culprit was simple personality differences. The more immediate problem, at least from Thras's perspective, was that in this case, he didn't know whether Thurfian was hoping to vindicate Thrawn or indict him. It was an important question, but largely irrelevant to the task that had been literally dropped on Thras's desk. He'd been charged with analyzing the data and finding the truth. And that was what he was going to do. And if the truth showed Thrawn had violated his oath, then that was what Thras's report would say.
"What do you mean, nothing?" Thurfian demanded, glaring across the desk at Thras. "There's something on that ranging laser profile."
"Yes, of course," Thras said hastily. "Forgive me for misspeaking. What I meant was, there's nothing suspicious there."
"Really?"
Thurfian said, his tone gone icy.
"You don't find all those modulations in the carrier frequency suspicious?"
"To be perfectly honest, Syndic, I find them to be largely the product of Mid-Captain Roscoe's fevered imagination," Thras said.
If there was one thing he'd learned growing up amid Myth family politics, it was to point all doubts and hazy claims at one of the other families.
"The rapid fluctuations along the main laser frequency are indeed there, but their pattern doesn't match up to any known encryption or open conversational pattern."
"Did you check for conversations in different trade languages?"
Thurfian asked.
"Or did you just look for patterns in Chiyun?"
"I tried Ta'aja and Sibisti," Thras said, choosing his words carefully. This was the most critical part of his whole presentation. "I was about to move on to Minisiat and Mis Kauf when I noticed that the laser's modulator disc had been replaced shortly after the incident."
Thurfian's forehead creased slightly.
"Which means?"
"The modulator controls the laser's frequency," Thras explained. "A ranging laser has to be able to work through different levels of dust, atmosphere, or solar wind, and its frequency has to be adjusted to compensate if it's going to deliver accurate information to the ship's gunners. It's similar to how spectrum lasers work."
"I don't need a lecture on military equipment,"
Thurfian interrupted brusquely.
"What does replacing the modulator have to do with anything?"
"I looked it up," Thras said. "It appears that modulators can sometimes develop a sort of flutter that manifests as small, rapid frequency shifts, not unlike those Mid-Captain Roscoe noted and brought to the Council's attention. The fact that the modulator was replaced after the incident strongly suggests it was suffering from this malfunction.
Strongly suggests?
Yes, sir,
Thras said, pointing at another family was good. Pointing into the unknown was sometimes even better.
Unfortunately, there's no way to know for certain whether or not the disc was faulty. If a piece of equipment can't be fixed, it's put into the recycler for materials recovery, and that's the end of it. And while there's a log entry for every piece of equipment that's replaced or recalibrated, only the date and time are listed, not the person who did the actual work or even necessarily the reason it was replaced.
Why not? Thurfian demanded. Crew members should be accountable for their actions.
I'm sure they are, Thras said. But since the crew leaders are the ones responsible for keeping their areas running, and since they're supposed to confirm their crew's work before logging the details, apparently, over the years, the Council decided that additional details would clog up the records and make it harder to search for anything meaningful.
Meaningful?
Thurfian all but spat out the word.
You're telling me this isn't meaningful?
I didn't mean it that way, sir,
Thras said, ducking his head in apology.
Please, forgive my inexact choice of words.
There's no excuse for verbal sloppiness, Syndic Thras,
Thurfian ground out.
If you can't learn precision, I suggest you ask to be demoted from Syndic and return to your previous position.
Again, my apologies, Thras said.
And when the personal attacks began, he knew the attacker had given up on the original goal.
Don't apologize,
Thurfian said.
Improve. That will be all.
Yes, Syndic.
Thras stood up and turned toward the door.
Could Senior Commander Thrawn have been the one who replaced the modulator?
Thurfian asked.
I don't know how or why he would, Thras said,
putting puzzlement into his voice as he turned back to face the other. Again, a place to step carefully.
Breach officers normally don't visit that section of a warship.
He was down there during the incident,
Thurfian reminded him, a fresh hint of suspicion rising into his voice.
When exactly was that modulator replaced?
14 hours after the Perala returned to hyperspace, Thras said. Senior Commander Thrawn was duty officer on the bridge at that time.
I see,
Thurfian muttered, the suspicion fading into sullenness.
Very well. Dismissed.
And just like that, it was over. Thras headed down the corridor back toward his office, keeping his expression neutral. Yes, the modulator swap had been logged 14 hours after the incident, but that didn't necessarily mean that was when the exchange had taken place. Yes, Thrawn was indeed on the bridge at that time, but it didn't necessarily mean someone else might not have made the replacement at someone's quiet request. Yes, Thras had tried to match the laser modulation to two of the best-known trade languages, but other sections of the Perala's log had stated that the Garweans first hailed the Chiss in Minisiat, one of the two languages he'd carefully put to the end of the line. Fortunately, Thurfian hadn't thought to question any of those points, which had enabled Thras to remain completely truthful while still blunting Thurfian's latest attack on Thrawn. How to walk that delicate line was yet another lesson he'd learned from family politics. He frowned, a sudden thought occurring to him. He'd noted in Thurfian that personal antagonism toward an individual could be detrimental to family loyalty. But was the opposite also true? Could Thras's friendship with Thrawn be clouding his own loyalty to the family in exactly the same way? He gave a little huff. No, of course not. Friendship and kinship were the whole basis of family, after all. Without those connections, the structure would collapse into a mass of individuals striving against one another for personal gain. For that matter, hadn't Patriarch Thuraki all but told him that, on the day when he'd sent Thras to beat back the Stybla's attempt to rematch Thrawn? Besides, loyalty to Thrawn was loyalty to the family. There were great things ahead of Thrawn, a future that would raise the myth to even greater heights than they enjoyed now. The Patriarch clearly saw it. And if a visionary like Thuraki recognized Thrawn's potential, who was Thras to say otherwise? And, speaking of opportunities, he checked his chrono. If the debriefing of the Parala officers was still on schedule, Thrawn should have finished up his testimony half an hour ago. If he was still on the ground, maybe Thras could grab his friend for a quick lunch before they both had to return to their respective duties. Mentally working out a short list of cafes near the Defense Force HQ he could offer, he pulled out his comm. Chapter 6. The Springhawk was still 11 hours out from Rapak, and Thalias was reading in the Skywalker suite's day room when she heard whimpering coming from Chiri's sleeping room. She frowned, setting down her questus and crossing to the hatch. Chiri had always been something of a noisy sleeper, making odd sounds and slurred words as she hit the dreaming part of her sleep cycle. It had taken Thalias a couple of months of waking up to the noises before her brain learned to recognize them as normal and allow her to sleep through the bouts. But there was noise, and there was noise, and frightened-sounding whimpers were something new. Chiri? Thalias called softly through the hatch. Are you all right? The whimpering stopped abruptly. Chiri? Thalias called again, wondering if her call had woken up the girl. But if so, why hadn't she answered? Chiri! Again there was no answer. Then, the whimpering started up again. Thalias had always tried not to intrude on Chiri's privacy, especially now that the girl was edging toward her mid-age years. But enough was enough. Chiri, I'm coming in, she announced, and keyed open the hatch. She'd expected to find Chiri tossing and turning like someone in a fever, her sheets and blankets twisted around her or falling off the bed. Instead, the girl was lying rigidly on her back, her eyes squeezed shut, her face twitching. Chiri, Thalias called, hurrying to her side. Chiri! Chiri's eyes snapped open, wide and frightened. Thalias! She gasped. I'm here, Chiri, Thalias said, sitting down on the bed beside her and taking the girl's hand. Are you okay?
I don't know,
Chiri said, the fear in her eyes slowly fading.
I saw it, Thalias. I saw all of it. The death and destruction. I saw it.
It was just a dream, Chiri, Thalias soothed. Just a horrible dream. Chiri squeezed her eyes shut.
No, it wasn't a dream. It was sunrise.
Sunrise? Thalias echoed, frowning. You mean the planet?
Yes,
Chiri murmured. That's not possible, Thalias said firmly. You never saw any of that. She broke off, a sudden knot twisting into her stomach. No, Jiri had never seen Sunrise's destruction. But the Magus had.
It's all right,
she said, forcing down the impulse to look over her shoulder in the direction of her own sleeping room and the hibernation chamber set against the wall.
Were these images coming from the Magus? Was she invading or influencing Chiri's thoughts or dreams? Was she somehow implanting her own memories into the girl?
You can go back to sleep. I'll stay with you a while if you'd like.
No!
Chiri said, the fading fear surging back again.
I mean, no, I don't want to go to sleep. I'll see Sunrise again. Can't we keep going? To Rapak, I mean? Can't we just go?
It's your sleep time, Chiri,
Thalias reminded her.
You need to rest.
But I can't sleep,
Chiri said, some pleading in her voice.
I don't want to sleep. Can't we just go?
I don't know, Thalias said. Let's find out. Come on, get dressed. We're going to the bridge.
Mid-Captain Simakro was on duty when Thalias and Chiri arrived.
Caregiver Skywalker,
he said in greeting, frowning in turn at each of them.
What are you doing here?
Chiri can't sleep,
Thalias explained.
She was hoping she could go back on duty.
Sorry, but this is her sleep period,
Simakro said, looking closely at the girl.
We can't do that.
I thought there were emergencies where the captain can run the ship Skywalker past the usual time limits,
Thalias said.
Where the captain can decide that,
Simakro said.
There's no provision for the Skywalker herself to do so.
Well, there should be,
Thalias said.
Can you call Senior Captain Thrawn and ask him?
Simakro shook his head.
Senior Captain Thrawn's off duty, the same as you are.
We need to talk to him.
Thalias glanced around, confirmed that no one else was close enough to overhear.
Tell him,
she added, lowering her voice to a whisper.
It concerns the Magus.
Simakro's eyes narrowed. He looked at Chiri, back at Thalias.
Go back to your suite, he said. I'll ask him to meet you there.
Thalias and Chiri were sitting on the couch together, the girl sipping at a box of warmed grillig juice, when Thrawn and Simakro arrived.
Caregiver,
the senior captain greeted Thalias gravely.
Skywalker, Miss Captain Simakro tells me there's a problem.
Yes,
Thalias said. She'd spent the last few minutes trying to organize her explanation into the most compact form possible.
Chiri's having nightmares of Sunrise, a place she's never visited, remembering events she's never seen.
I see, Thrawn said. What do you propose?
Thalias drew back a little. She'd expected to have to go into a lot more detail before he even believed her, let alone started looking for a solution.
Chiri doesn't think she can sleep anymore, at least for now,
she said.
She'd like to go back to the bridge and continue our journey to Rapak.
I see.
Thrawn turned his eyes onto Chiri.
Do you concur, Skywalker Chiri?
Yes, sir,
Chiri said in a small voice.
Every time I try to sleep...
It's all right,
Thrawn said, holding out a calming hand.
You don't have to explain further.
Mid-Captain, what's the hyperdrive status? The new coils have been installed, and the diagnostics are nearly complete,
Simakro said.
4 more minutes, 5 at most, and we'll be able to leave.
Thank you,
Thrawn said. Ciri, one final time. Do you wish to return to duty?
Yes, Senior Captain,
Ciri said.
Caregiver?
I think it would be best, sir, Thalias confirmed. I'll stay with her and keep watch as long as she's there. If she seems to be tiring or losing concentration, I'll bring her out.
Very well.
Thrawn turned to Simacro.
Alert the bridge, Mid-Captain. We return to hyperspace in 10 minutes.
Thalias was gazing out the bridge viewport at the hyperspace swirl, feeling dullness and fatigue pulling at her eyelids, when the aroma of hot cacao leaf snapped her back to full alertness. She turned. Thrawn was coming up behind her with a steaming non-spill mug.
Senior Captain? She said, nodding wearily at him. I thought you were off duty.
I am, Thrawn said, handing her the mug. As are you and Skywalker Ciri. How is she doing?
As far as I can tell, she's fine, Thalias said, savoring the aroma before taking a sip. Not too hot and extra strong. Exactly what she needed right now. She doesn't seem to be affected by the images while in third sight, or when she's awake, either.
So just in her dream state,
Thrawn said thoughtfully.
Was this the first time she's had these dreams?
It's the first time I heard her in the middle of one, Thalias said. But I asked her about it while we were waiting for you, and it turns out she's had 2 or 3 others over the past 2 weeks. Not nearly as vivid or terrifying, though, she said. Just odd.
And all of them occurring after we brought the mages out of hibernation to look at the Nyx brooch.
Thalias nodded. So he was thinking the same thing she was.
Yes.
For a moment, Thrawn was silent.
I checked the hibernation chamber, he said. There's no indication of any malfunction.
So how is she doing it?
I don't know,
Thrawn conceded.
Perhaps her dreams are somehow intersecting with Ciri's.
I thought people in hibernation didn't dream.
Chiss in hibernation don't,
Thrawn said.
But the Magis is an alien. Her mental and physiological responses may be different.
He nodded toward Ciri.
There is, of course, one other obvious possibility.
Thalias winced.
You think she's connecting somehow with Chiri's third sight?
It's a possibility, Thrawn said. Especially given the Magus' still undefined connection to the beyond.
That seems so strange,
Thalias said, shaking her head.
To connect with something you can't see or touch?
Very strange indeed,
Thrawn said. Thalias looked at him, feeling her eyes narrow. There'd been a hint of dry humor in his tone.
It's nothing like third sight,
she insisted.
We just see dangers that are in front of the ship and maneuver to get around them. We're not connecting with anything.
Perhaps,
Thrawn said.
The question has been debated for centuries without a resolution. Again, I find myself thinking about my conversations with General Skywalker concerning the Force. There was a certain vagueness in his descriptions, too. But he seemed quite capable of tapping it for both power and insight.
Well, it's creepy,
Thalias declared darkly.
Especially when she's picking on someone like Ciri. Do you think we should, I don't know, wake her up and tell her to stop?
I think not,
Thrawn said. If it's not deliberate, the effect on Shiri would likely distress her. If it is deliberate, we would be confirming for her that her scheme is working. He hesitated. More concerning to me is that if she's affecting Shiri this strongly while asleep, the danger may be much greater once she's conscious.
Yes, that would be bad,
Thalias agreed. Though if the connection was there only when Shiri was asleep... But they really didn't have enough data one way or another on that.
So what do we do?
We continue on this path, Thrawn said. We're currently 7 hours from Rapak by Skywalker. 49 by jump by jump. We'll keep going as long as Shiri can stay awake. Then continue jump by jump while she sleeps. If she's again woken early by more nightmares, and if she's alert enough, she can again take over navigation.
You're talking a lot of awake time, Senior Captain, Thalias warned, looking down at Shiri.
The girl still looked all right, but Shiri knew the toll this was taking on her mind and body.
More than is legally allowed.
I know, Thrawn said. But a ship's captain has leeway in extraordinary circumstances. At any rate, a rest period hardly seems useful if she's unable to rest.
That may be, Thalias said. But I don't know how much she can take before she risks serious damage.
I did look into that possibility, Thrawn said. The medical data suggests that in the case of prolonged wakefulness, her body will force her to sleep before any damage occurs. It also suggests that a sleep cycle continually interrupted by nightmares isn't much better for her either. Still, even if she only gets 2 or 3 hours sleep at a time before we reach Rapak, we'll arrive in less than 2 days. At this point, I think the best thing we can do for her is get her there as quickly as possible and get the mages off the Springhawk. Thalias breathed out a sigh. She still didn't like it, but couldn't think of anything better to offer.
All right, she said. I'll stay here and watch her until she needs to sleep.
Or until you need to sleep, Thrawn said. I can have someone else watch her.
Thalia squared her shoulders.
I'll stay here, she repeated firmly. Until she needs to sleep.
Understood, Thrawn said,
and Thalia could hear the quiet approval in his tone.
Carry on, caregiver.
The trance ended. The great presence faded back into the mists of thought and waking dream, and with a final twitch of his fingers, Kilori of Uandualon brought the Kilji war cruiser Anvil out of hyperspace. With a tired sigh, he pulled off his sensory deprivation headset.
Why do we stop here, Pathfinder?
A gruff voice came from behind him, chewing the Ta'arja words like they were sour fruit. Kilori's cheek winglets twitched in disgust and annoyance. General Crowfib, commander of the Anvil, was short, loud, impatient, and his wrinkled, rubbery skin was utterly repulsive. All other things being equal, Kilori would probably have refused the job of guiding Crowfib and his ship to Rapak. But this trip had been undertaken under Jixtus's orders. And with Jixtus, nothing else was quite equal.
The hammer has lagged a bit, General, and is a few minutes behind us,
Kilori explained, half turning to face him.
You said earlier that you wanted both ships to arrive at the same time, so I thought we'd stop an easy jump outside the Rapak system and wait for them to catch up.
Foolish and enlightened,
Crowfib said, his voice fairly dripping with disdain.
We are here, and Colonel Tildis is in hyperspace. He will not know we've stopped and merely pass us by unnoticed.
I don't think so, Kilori said. I expect the hammer to appear nearby in approximately 4 minutes.
Crowfip made some rude-sounding noises in his own language and shifted his attention to the status displays. Kilori turned back to his nav board, his winglets twitching with some scorn of his own. He wasn't surprised at the Kilji's skepticism. The fact that Pathfinders could sense, locate, and follow each other in hyperspace was a closely held secret. Still, Jixtus probably knew, and General Yiv had certainly known, and anyone who had dreams of conquest really should have done some basic research into the people who made long-distance travel feasible. Besides, anyone who talked about enlightenment as much as Crowfip should have learned a little more understanding and humility regarding the limits of his knowledge. Kilori reached down to the warmer beside his knee and pulled out his flask of Galara tea leaf. This whole mission was something of a mystery to him. Not the kind that was pleasantly intriguing, but the kind that made him nervous. From what little Jixtus had told him, it sounded like the Grisks had sent at least a couple of quiet probes into the Rapoq system, all of them having apparently been chased away. Whatever Jixtus's goal was, sending in a pair of Kilji warships sounded like a serious escalation. The big question was, why Rapoq, of all places? Kilori had been there once before, hired by the dangerous Chiss military leader Thrawn, during the period when one of General Yiv's commanders had been occupying and blockading the system. Rapoq was an off-the-path place, not allied or even trading partners with anyone Kilori knew of, with nothing special in the way of resources or inhabitants. Kilori hadn't known at the time why the Nicardoon were even interested in the place, and he still didn't know. But Yiv and the Nicardoon were the past. This was the present, and now it was Jixtus and these Kilgis who had set their sights on Rapoq. Unfortunately, Jixtus had also set his sights on Kilori himself. He scowled out the viewport at the starry sky. He'd told Kilori about Thrawn hiring him to fly to Rapoq. And yet, as Jixtus had pointed out, for the most part, Chiss warships seemed perfectly capable of traveling the Chaos without Pathfinders or any of the other region's navigators. It was a mystery that had caught Jixtus's attention, a puzzle he'd now handed over to Kilori to solve. The problem was, Kilori couldn't. He'd looked into the matter, quietly and unobtrusively, sifting through the records at his home base of Navigator Concourse 447, and talking to other Pathfinders. The obvious answer was that the Chiss had discovered some hitherto unknown group with the gift of navigation, and had kept their services completely to themselves. But the more Kilori studied the problem, the less likely that seemed. The gift was exceedingly rare, and sifting those individuals out of a species no one had ever heard of would be nearly impossible. Which led to the more intriguing possibility that Jixtus had raised. Millennia ago, the Chiss had traveled extensively in lesser space, where legends said the inhabitants used computerized machines to chart their way between the stars. If the Chiss had brought such machines back with them, and if one of those machines could be captured and studied...
Your stated time is up, Pathfinder,
Crowfip growled. Kilori's wandering thoughts snapped back to the present.
There are yet 20 seconds left,
he pointed out. Crowfip growled something else, probably another reference to Kilori's sadly unenlightened status. Which was fine. Kilori didn't really care what the bombastic Kilji thought about him. What he did care about was the fact that no one had let him in on the master plan, A pair of warships obviously implied expectation of combat. But whether the Kilgees were here to study, to conquer, Crowfip used that word a lot too, or to destroy, was unclear. Maybe things like that didn't make a difference to Jixtus or the Kilgees, but they made a huge difference to Kilori. He had no stake in what was about to happen, and he'd long ago decided he had no interest in leaving his bones floating among the debris of someone else's war. Fortunately, most of a Pathfinder's time aboard ship was spent on the bridge, and most ship bridges were well equipped with escape pods. On the anvil, the two closest were directly to either side of him, the portside one slightly closer to his station than the starboard one, but either would do in a pinch. The sensor operator spoke up in the Kilgee language. Crowfip answered in kind, and to Kilori's ears, he sounded even more annoyed than he had earlier. Small wonder. In the distance, off to the anvil's side, close enough to be visible through the viewport, was the picket cruiser Hammer, having arrived right on Kilori's projected schedule. The unintelligible conversation continued, and Kilori felt his cheek winglets twitch in cynical amusement. Crowfip was clearly trying to put off the moment when he'd have to admit to Kilori that the Pathfinder had been right. As if Kilori couldn't see that for himself. But it was Crowfip's schedule, and his time to waste if he chose to do so. Kilori, for his part, was perfectly happy to extend his unplanned break. Finally, the Kilgee couldn't put it off any longer.
"The Hammer has arrived," he growled, switching back to T'Arja. "Why do we still stop here?"
"I'm merely awaiting your instructions, General,"
Kilori said, choosing the T'Arja word that could mean either orders or suggestions. Not in any way insubordinate, but guaranteed to rankle if Crowfip was skilled enough with the language to catch the nuance.
"Then go,"
Crowfip bit out, sounding even more annoyed. Apparently he was skilled enough.
"I obey,"
Kilori said, keying the comm signal that would alert the Hammer's